A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Daniel sent us this one. He and Hannah share a bed that's 140 centimeters wide, and he's finding it cramped. He wants to know if bed size has actually been studied in relation to sleep quality, and he's also wondering about the broader question of making your bedroom a proper sleep haven. He mentions decluttering, having a space you can actually use rather than just crash in, and specifically asks about projectors in the bedroom. They've got a Nebula capsule, they watch movies sometimes, and he's wondering if that's an absolute no-go or if the sleep coach orthodoxy on blue light might be a bit rigid.
Oh, this is a fantastic prompt. And 140 centimeters, that's roughly a full size, sometimes called a double, for two adults.
Which, let's be honest, is about the width of a generous park bench.
It's tight. And by the way, fun fact, DeepSeek V4 Pro is writing our script today.
Is that so? Well, DeepSeek, I hope you've had your coffee. Let's see what you got.
Bed size. This is actually something the research has looked at, and the findings are, well, they're not subtle. A study published in the Journal of Chiropractic Medicine back in 2010 compared sleep quality in couples across different mattress sizes. Couples on a queen or king bed reported significantly better sleep quality, less partner disturbance, and reduced musculoskeletal pain compared to those on full-size beds. The numbers were striking, something like a 62% reduction in sleep disturbances just from having adequate space.
Wait, 62%? That's not marginal.
It's enormous. And here's the mechanism. When two adults share a bed that's 140 centimeters wide, each person gets about 70 centimeters of personal space. That's narrower than a standard crib mattress. A crib mattress is about 70 centimeters wide. So Daniel and Hannah are each sleeping in a space no wider than what we give a baby.
That's a devastating comparison, and I'm gonna make sure Daniel hears it.
Compare that to a king-size bed, which is about 103 centimeters wide. Each person gets nearly a meter of space. You can roll over without elbowing your partner in the face. You can shift positions without a negotiation.
This isn't just about comfort, right? The partner disturbance thing you mentioned, what's actually happening there?
This gets into what sleep researchers call sleep fragmentation. When your partner moves, you might not fully wake up, but your brain registers the disturbance. It's called a microarousal. Your brain briefly shifts into a lighter sleep stage. If that happens 10, 15, 20 times a night, you're accumulating what's essentially sleep deprivation even if you never remember waking up. A study from the University of Surrey tracked couples sleeping in different bed sizes and found that on the narrower beds, both partners showed increased cortisol levels the next morning.
Cortisol being the stress hormone.
So you're not just uncomfortable in the moment, you're waking up with a higher baseline stress level. And that affects everything, decision-making, emotional regulation, even how you interact with your spouse the next day.
Which means the bed size argument Daniel and Hannah are having might actually be partly caused by the bed size itself. They're snippy with each other because they've been micro-aroused 20 times.
That's the cruel irony. The thing they're arguing about is making them worse at resolving the argument.
Okay, so let's talk about what you do when you literally can't fit a bigger bed. Daniel says their apartment is very small. You can't renovate the walls. What's the play?
This is where the mattress topper Hannah got becomes interesting. Daniel mentions she has an outstandingly comfy one, but he still finds it cramped. The topper addresses pressure points and temperature regulation, which are important, but it doesn't address spatial restriction. If the fundamental problem is that you can't move, no amount of foam is going to fix that.
The topper is solving a different problem.
A real problem, but not the one Daniel's experiencing. Here's what the literature suggests for couples stuck with a smaller bed. First, synchronized sleep schedules matter more when space is tight. If you're both in bed at the same time and both asleep, movement tends to be less disruptive than when one person comes in late and disturbs a sleeping partner.
Going to bed at the same time actually matters more with a small bed.
Second, separate blankets. This is the Scandinavian approach. Two twin duvets on one mattress. It sounds trivial, but blanket stealing is a major source of sleep disturbance in couples, and it's amplified when you're already physically close. A study from the University of Leeds found that couples using separate duvets reported fewer sleep disruptions, independent of bed size.
That's such a simple intervention.
It costs $40 and requires zero additional floor space. And third, and this is the one nobody likes, if the bed is genuinely too small and you can't upgrade, there's a legitimate case for separate sleeping arrangements, at least some nights. The idea that couples must share a bed is historically contingent and culturally specific. It wasn't the norm in many societies until relatively recently.
Right, the sleep divorce conversation, which always gets framed as a relationship failure. But what you're saying is, it might actually be a relationship preservation strategy.
If you're waking up resentful every morning because your partner's elbow was in your ribcage all night, that resentment accumulates. Sleeping separately and being well rested and pleasant with each other during the day might be better for the relationship than sharing a bed and being exhausted and irritable.
I suspect Hannah would have opinions about this framing.
I suspect she would, but the data is pretty clear. And Daniel mentioned hotels. When they stay in a hotel, he can stretch out and enjoy it. That's telling. He's not saying he prefers sleeping alone. He's saying he prefers having adequate space. The hotel bed is probably a king, and suddenly sleep feels restorative rather than something he endures.
All right, let's shift to the broader question. Making your bedroom a sleep haven. Daniel mentioned decluttering and having a space you can actually use rather than just crash in. This feels like the sleep hygiene conversation, but with an interior design angle.
This is where the research gets interesting, because it's not just keep it dark and cool. The psychological dimension of the bedroom matters enormously. There was a fascinating study out of St. Cian, Lawrence University, that examined what they called bedroom chaos. Visual clutter, items unrelated to sleep, work materials in the bedroom, and correlated it with sleep onset latency, which is how long it takes you to fall asleep.
What they find?
People with cluttered multi-purpose bedrooms took an average of 18 minutes longer to fall asleep than those with bedrooms dedicated primarily to sleep. And the mechanism they proposed was cognitive. Visual clutter creates what they called unfinished business, cues in the brain. Your eyes land on the pile of laundry, the stack of paperwork, the exercise equipment you haven't used, and each one triggers a microdose of stress or guilt or task reminder that keeps your brain from winding down.
It's not just aesthetic. The clutter is literally generating cognitive load at the moment you're trying to offload it.
And this connects to what we know about the pre-sleep cognitive state. There's a concept in sleep psychology called pre-sleep cognitive arousal. It's that thing where you lie down and suddenly your brain starts replaying every awkward conversation you've had since middle school. Clutter in the bedroom feeds that. It gives your brain visual anchors for worry.
Daniel mentioned wanting a space you can actually use, rather than just crash in. That's interesting phrasing. He's not saying the bedroom should only be for sleep. He's saying it should be a space you want to spend time in. That feels intentional.
That's actually a more nuanced take than the standard sleep hygiene advice, which tends to be absolutist. The bedroom is for sleep and sex, period. No reading, no screens, no nothing. The reasoning behind that is classical conditioning. You want your brain to associate the bedroom with sleep so strongly that walking in triggers a relaxation response. And there's truth to that, but it's incomplete.
Because humans aren't lab rats, and bedrooms aren't Skinner boxes.
The conditioning model works, but it ignores the fact that for many people, especially in small apartments, the bedroom is one of the few private spaces they have. If you can't use it for anything but unconsciousness, you're losing a significant percentage of your living space. The more sophisticated approach is what some researchers call sleep-compatible use, activities that are relaxing, low stimulation, and don't introduce sleep-disrupting elements.
Which brings us to the projector.
The nebula capsule. All right, let's talk about screens in the bedroom, because this is where the absolutism of sleep advice really grates on people, and Daniel's instinct that something's off is worth examining.
The standard line is, no screens. Blue light suppresses melatonin. End of story.
The standard line is not wrong about the mechanism. Photoreceptors in the retina, called intrinsically photosensitive retinal ganglion cells, IPRGCs, are specifically sensitive to short wavelength light, which is blue light, peaking around 480 nanometers. When they're stimulated, they signal the suprachiasmatic nucleus in the hypothalamus to suppress melatonin production. This is well established. A 2014 study in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences found that reading on an iPad before bed suppressed melatonin by 55% compared to reading the physical book and shifted the circadian phase by more than an hour and a half.
55% is a lot of melatonin.
It's substantial. But here's where the nuance comes in, and where I think the absolutist advice falls apart. The effect is dose-dependent, duration-dependent, and distance-dependent. A projector is not a tablet 6 inches from your face.
That's a crucial distinction. The nebula capsule is projecting onto a wall or ceiling, probably from several feet away.
The intensity of light reaching your retina falls off with the square of the distance. A projector on a wall 10 feet away is delivering far less luminous intensity to your eyes than a phone held at reading distance. Plus, projectors typically have lower luminance than direct view displays. And here's something most people don't know. Not all blue light is equal. The melanopic lux. That's the measure of how much a light source stimulates those IBRGC cells. Varies enormously between devices. Projectors tend to have lower melanopic lux than phones or tablets.
The projector might not be as bad as the phone.
Might not be, but not as bad isn't the same as good. The question is whether it's bad enough to meaningfully affect sleep. And Daniel's own experience is relevant here. He says he never feels like it actually keeps him up. Subjective experience isn't nothing. The research on electronics and sleep does show individual variation. Some people's melatonin systems are more sensitive to light than others. Age matters too. Melatonin suppression from light exposure decreases with age, which is one reason older adults often have more fragmented sleep.
Daniel might be one of those people who's less sensitive, and the projector's lower intensity might put him below his personal threshold for disruption.
That's plausible. But I'd add a caveat, you can be disrupting your sleep architecture without feeling subjectively wired. That's the insidious thing about light exposure. You might fall asleep fine. Sleep onset latency might be normal, but the quality of your early night sleep could be affected. The first third of the night is when you get most of your slow wave sleep, and if your melatonin onset was delayed or blunted, that slow wave sleep might be less robust. You wouldn't necessarily know unless you were tracking it.
What's the practical takeaway? If you're going to use a projector, what would you do to minimize the impact?
Couple of things. First, timing matters. If you're watching something and finishing 30 to 60 minutes before sleep, that's much better than watching right up until you close your eyes. That buffer allows melatonin to begin rising. Second, content matters enormously. A calm nature documentary in low volume is very different from an action movie or a tense drama. The emotional arousal from content might actually be more sleep disruptive than the light exposure. Third, you can adjust the projector's brightness and color temperature. Some projectors have a warm mode that reduces blue output. And fourth, this is the one nobody wants to hear. If you're having sleep issues, try 2 weeks without the projector and see what happens. Not because the projector is definitely the problem, but because the only way to know is to remove the variable.
That's a very reasonable approach. Do the experiment on yourself.
End of one trial. We talked about this with the sleep study. Objective data about your own body is more valuable than population-level averages.
Let's go back to the bedroom environment more broadly. Daniel mentioned decluttering, but there's more to it than that. What does the research say about the ideal sleep environment?
The National Sleep Foundation did a comprehensive survey a few years back. They polled about 1,500 people and looked at what environmental factors correlated with better sleep. The big four were darkness, cool temperature, quiet, and comfort. But the interesting part was the specifics. For temperature, the sweet spot was between 60 and 67 degrees Fahrenheit. That's about 15 to 19 Celsius. Below or above that range, sleep quality declined measurably.
That's cooler than most people keep their bedrooms.
Your core body temperature needs to drop by about 1 to 2 degrees Fahrenheit to initiate sleep. A cool room facilitates that. A warm room fights it. And here's a detail. The temperature drop is partly why a warm bath before bed actually helps you sleep. It sounds counterintuitive, but the warm bath causes vasodilation in your extremities. Your hands and feet flush with blood, and that dumps heat from your core, which is the signal your body needs.
The bath triggers the temperature drop that a cool room then maintains.
It's a 1-2 punch, and for Daniel and Hannah in Jerusalem, where summers are hot, this is non-trivial. If the bedroom isn't air-conditioned, or if the AC is set too warm, they're fighting their own thermoregulation.
What about noise? Jerusalem apartments can be.
Noise is one of the most studied sleep disruptors, and it's not just about volume, it's about unpredictability. Continuous white noise is far less disruptive than intermittent noise, even at the same decibel level. Your brain habituates to steady noise, but it can't habituate to unpredictable sounds because, from an evolutionary perspective, an unpredictable sound might be a predator. So the brain keeps one ear open, so to speak.
Which is why white noise machines work. They're not masking the sound so much as making it predictable.
They turn unpredictable noise into a steady acoustic blanket. And there's good research on this. A study in critical care medicine found that white noise in hospital ICUs, which are notoriously noisy, improves sleep quality for patients. If it works in an ICU, it'll work in an apartment.
What about the visual environment beyond light? Colors, textures, that sort of thing.
The research on color and sleep is less robust. A lot of it is based on self-report and cultural associations. But there is some interesting work on what's called visual complexity. Bedrooms with high visual complexity, busy patterns, lots of contrasting colors, many small objects, tend to be rated as less relaxing than rooms with lower visual complexity. This aligns with the clutter research. Your visual system is always processing, even when you're not consciously looking at things. A visually busy room keeps your visual cortex more active.
Simplicity isn't just an aesthetic preference. It's reducing cognitive load at a perceptual level.
That's the theory, and it connects to something Daniel said about wanting a space you can use, not just crash in. I think what he's describing is a bedroom that feels intentional, where everything in it is there for a reason, and the reason is compatible with relaxation and restoration. That's not the same as a sterile, empty room that's only for unconsciousness. It's a curated space.
Curation requires some thought about what you include and what you exclude. Let's talk about what the research says about specific bedroom elements. What about plants?
Some studies suggest indoor plants improve air quality and have psychological benefits, including reduced stress. A study from the Journal of Physiological Anthropology found that interacting with indoor plants reduced sympathetic nervous system activity. That's the fight or flight branch. But other research raises concerns about plants in the bedroom specifically because they release carbon dioxide at night and can harbor mold in the soil. The CO2 concern is probably overblown unless you're sleeping in a sealed greenhouse, but the mold thing is real if you're sensitive.
Maybe plants in the living room, not the bedroom.
Or low-maintenance plants in well-draining pots, and not directly next to the bed. Succulents and snake plants are popular for bedrooms because they're low allergen and snake plants actually perform CAM photosynthesis. They take in CO2 at night, which is unusual, so they don't contribute to nighttime CO2 levels.
What about the bed itself? Beyond size, what matters?
Mattress firmness is the big one, and it's frustratingly individual. But there is some systematic research. A study in The Lancet back in 2003. This was a randomized controlled trial, which is rare for mattress studies, found that medium firm mattresses were associated with less back pain and better sleep quality compared to firm mattresses. The mechanism is spinal alignment. Too soft and your spine sags, too firm and you get pressure points at the shoulders and hips. Pillow height matters for cervical spine alignment. Too high and you're craning your neck, too low and your head tilts back. The ideal is for your head to be in a neutral position aligned with your spine. This is especially relevant for side sleepers, which we've talked about before. Side sleepers need a thicker pillow to fill the gap between the shoulder and the head. Back sleepers need thinner pillows. Stomach sleepers need very thin pillows, or none at all.
Daniel didn't mention his sleeping position. That might be relevant to why he feels cramped. If he's a side sleeper who wants to extend an arm or shift positions, the spatial constraint is more acute.
Side sleepers need more lateral space. And if both partners are side sleepers trying to face away from each other, which is common because breathing in your partner's face isn't pleasant, you've got two people competing for the outer edges of a narrow bed.
Which means someone's always losing.
The loser is probably not sleeping well.
Let's circle back to the projector question because I think there's a broader point here about sleep advice and how it's communicated. Daniel's instinct that the absolutism feels off. I think a lot of people feel that way. The sleep hygiene rules get presented as commandments, and if you break one, you failed.
That's a problem, because the anxiety about breaking the rules can itself be sleep disruptive. There's a term for this, orthosomnia. It was coined in a 2017 paper in the Journal of Clinical Sleep Medicine to describe people who become so obsessed with optimizing their sleep tracker data that they develop insomnia from the anxiety. The pursuit of perfect sleep becomes the thing that ruins sleep.
That is deeply ironic and also deeply human.
It's the quantified self movement eating its own tail. And I think the absolutist sleep hygiene advice can create a milder version of the same dynamic. If you believe that any blue light after 8 p.m. will destroy your sleep, and then you watch a movie with your wife because that's the only time you have together, you might lie down afterward feeling guilty and anxious about the sleep you've supposedly ruined. That guilt and anxiety is probably more disruptive than the blue light from a projector across the room.
The advice becomes counterproductive.
For some people, yes. The better approach is what some sleep researchers call sleep flexibility. Understanding the principles, knowing your own sensitivity, and making trade-offs consciously. If watching a movie with Hannah on the projector is a source of connection and relaxation for Daniel, the psychological benefit of that connection might outweigh the physiological cost of the light exposure. Relationships matter for sleep too. Loneliness and marital conflict are both associated with poorer sleep. If the projector ritual is bonding time, eliminating it in the name of sleep hygiene might actually worsen sleep through a different pathway.
That's a really important point. The bedroom isn't just a sleep chamber, it's a relational space. And for couples, the relational dynamics play into sleep quality in both directions. Bad sleep makes you snippy. Being snippy makes sleep worse.
It's a feedback loop, and the bedroom environment is the stage on which that loop plays out. If the bedroom feels like a place of connection and comfort, that association feeds into better sleep. If it feels like a cramped, contested space where you're constantly negotiating for room, that's a different association entirely.
What would you tell Daniel if you were giving him a prescription for his bedroom?
First, I'd acknowledge the constraint. The bed can't get bigger, the room can't expand, so we work within that. Separate blankets immediately. It's the cheapest, highest impact intervention available. Second, evaluate the projector honestly. Not by whether you feel wired after watching, but by whether you wake up feeling restored. If the answer is yes, the projector's probably fine. If you're not sure, try 2 weeks without it and see. Third, declutter ruthlessly. Anything in the bedroom that isn't related to sleep, relaxation, or your relationship should find another home. The visual field should be calm. Fourth, temperature. If you're not already cooling the room to 18 or 19 Celsius at night, try it. It's the most evidence-backed environmental intervention after darkness. And fifth, consider the relational piece. If the bed size is a genuine source of conflict, address that directly rather than letting it simmer. The resentment is probably more sleep disruptive than the size itself.
That last one is underrated. The emotional environment of the bedroom is part of the sleep environment. You can have the perfect mattress and the perfect temperature and blackout curtains, but if you're silently furious at your spouse, none of it matters.
There's actually research on this. A study from the University of Pittsburgh found that couples who reported higher marital satisfaction had better sleep efficiency. That's the percentage of time in bed actually spent sleeping, than couples with lower satisfaction even when controlling for other factors like age, health, and income. The effect size was modest, but significant. Sleep and relationships are deeply intertwined.
The sleep haven Daniel's asking about isn't just a physical space. It's a psychological and relational one, too.
And I think that's what makes his prompt so good. He's asking about bed size and projectors and decluttering, but what he's really asking about is how to create a space where he and Hannah can both rest well, together, in a small apartment, with all the constraints that entails. That's a much richer question than, what's the ideal bedroom temperature?
It's the difference between optimizing a room and designing a life.
And the research supports a both-and approach. The physical environment matters. Bed size, temperature, light, noise, all of it. But the relational and psychological environment matters too, and the two interact. A cramped bed is physically uncomfortable, but it's also a source of tension that can bleed into the relationship. A projector might emit some blue light, but it's also a source of shared enjoyment that strengthens the relationship. You can't evaluate these things in isolation.
Which is why the absolutist sleep advice often fails. It treats the bedroom as an isolated system with one function, when in reality it's embedded in a whole human life with multiple, sometimes competing, functions.
That's not to say the principles are wrong. Darkness is better than light for sleep. Cool is better than warm. Quiet is better than noise. Space is better than crowding. These are true. But they're true in a context, and the context includes things like, this is the only time my wife and I have to watch a movie together, or we literally cannot fit a bigger bed in this apartment.
You make the best trade-offs you can with awareness of what you're trading.
That's the mature approach, and it's more effective than trying to achieve some perfect, optimized sleep environment that doesn't exist outside of a sleep lab.
Let's talk about one more thing Daniel mentioned. The idea of the bedroom as a space you can use, rather than just crash in. I think there's an interesting tension here, with the standard advice to reserve the bedroom for sleep. Daniel seems to be pushing back on that, and I think he's onto something.
The bedroom only for sleep. Advice comes from stimulus control therapy, which is a well-established treatment for chronic insomnia. The idea is that if you've spent months or years lying awake in bed, your brain has learned to associate the bed with wakefulness and frustration. The treatment is to break that association by only being in bed when you're sleepy and getting out of bed if you're awake for more than 20 minutes. It's effective for insomnia, but it's not necessarily the right prescription for someone who doesn't have insomnia and just wants a more pleasant bedroom.
It's a therapeutic intervention, not a universal design principle.
And applying a therapeutic intervention for a clinical condition to the general population is a category error. If you sleep fine, you don't need to train your brain to associate the bed with sleep. It already does that. You can use the bedroom for reading, for conversation, for watching a movie with your spouse, and it won't break anything.
Provided those activities are relaxing and not stimulating.
Don't put a treadmill and a work desk in the bedroom, but a comfortable chair for reading, a projector for occasional movies, some music. These are reasonable additions to a bedroom that make it a pleasant living space rather than just a sleep pod.
There's something to be said for a bedroom that you actually want to spend time in. If the bedroom is austere and uninviting, you might avoid going to bed until you're exhausted, which creates its own problems. A bedroom that feels welcoming might actually encourage better sleep timing.
Sleep procrastination, staying up later than you intend because you don't want to go to bed, is a recognized phenomenon. Some of it is about not wanting the day to end, but some of it is about the bedroom not being an appealing destination. If the bedroom is a haven rather than a duty station, you might be more inclined to go there at a reasonable hour.
We've got bed size, separate blankets, temperature, decluttering, the projector question, and the relational dimension. That's a pretty comprehensive answer to Daniel's prompt. Anything we haven't covered?
One thing I'd add about the projector specifically, the content matters enormously, and I don't think that gets enough attention in the screen time before bed discussion. Watching a slow-paced nature documentary is very different from watching a thriller or scrolling social media. The emotional and cognitive arousal from content might be more impactful than the light exposure, especially with a projector at distance. There's research from the University of Gothenburg showing that emotionally arousing content before bed increases sleep onset latency and reduces slow-wave sleep, independent of screen type.
It's not just whether you're using a screen, but what you're using it for.
How you're using it. Passive viewing of calm content is probably fine for most people. Active engagement, scrolling, gaming, arguing on social media is a different beast. The projector setup Daniel described sounds like passive, shared viewing, which is about as benign as screen use before bed gets.
Unless they're watching horror movies.
Don't watch horror movies before bed. That seems obvious, but apparently it needs to be said.
I feel like that's just good life advice, not just sleep advice. All right. So, to summarize for Daniel, the bed is objectively small for two adults, and the research backs up his feeling that it matters. Within the constraints, separate blankets, synchronized bedtimes, and a ruthlessly decluttered visual environment are the highest impact interventions. The projector is probably fine, especially if the content is calm and there's a buffer before sleep, but he should test it by going without for 2 weeks. Temperature matters more than most people think. Aim for 18 or 19 Celsius, and the relational dynamic around the bed size is worth addressing directly, because the tension about it might be more disruptive than the size itself.
That's a solid prescription, and I'd add, if they ever move to a place with a bigger bedroom, prioritize the bed. It's one of the highest return investments you can make in your daily well-being. You spend a third of your life in bed. The cost per hour of use over the lifetime of a good mattress and bed frame is negligible.
That's the economist's argument for a king-size bed.
It's the sleep researcher's argument with an economist framing, but it's true.
Before we wrap up, I believe it's time for something completely unrelated.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
The national animal of Scotland is the unicorn. It has been since the 12th century, when it was adopted as a symbol of purity and power by William I.
Right.
That's a thing I now know.
This has been My Weird Prompts, thanks to our producer, Hilbert Flumingtop. If you enjoyed this episode, leave us a review wherever you get your podcasts. It helps. We'll be back soon.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.